Can you hear me without the microphone? There are three stories, as Ra said, and the second of them is Our Glad, and Our Glad is my Auntie Gladys, and she was, there usually is at least one in the family, and it's always a woman who remembers things, remembers everything, actually. She's kind of the receptacle of all family knowledge and legend, and the speaker forth of it, actually. And this is connected quite, I mean, it is largely our family history, and there's an awful lot of family history around, people do it the whole time. But I've tried to make a fiction out of it, which is something distinct, feeling quite free to do what I liked with it. But it's forever rooted in my mind with my mother having been widowed and continuing to live on her own in Deganwy, in North Wales, and alternating weekends, my brother or I would drive over and stay the weekend with her. And then when it was my turn, I would come back then, although I don't like driving and getting nearer and nearer Manchester on the motorways always just. Anyway, I would come across and to visit Gladys, who was on her own in this really nice little house in a terrace backing onto a school. And there she'd be. She knew I was coming and she was waiting. And the opening of the story is, as it were, pretty well exactly as it was, but with the license to bring, I think Ra's very patient about this, but it's quite a long time since I used speech marks. and he's very strict about whether it's intelligible or not, but mostly, and on the whole, I like that kind of eliding out of what people in inverted commas are saying, and then might be what they're thinking, and even going over into what somebody else is thinking or saying, without it actually becoming a model. That's the whole point of it. So you'll hear that from the start. The actual speaker is at first very clear, and then it's a sort of wandering. Come in, she said. Start talking. Start listening more like. Let the asking and the telling and the listening begin where we left off. Or before that, if you want. Listen to me remembering an early part again, the same, only different, again. And tell me again, or for the first time, what you have known for years and what you have just found out. Tell me how you see things now. But come in here first while I make the tea. The eats were ready and waiting on a trolley, so there was hardly room for the two of them in the kitchen. He would stand at the window, looking down the little garden to the fence. How's your mum managing, she asked, without your dad? Turning, he answered her. She wanted to know. He answered truthfully. She sometimes thinks I am dad, he said. She thinks I've come home on leave. She asks, how long can I stay? I don't mind her thinking I'm him, he said. Not really. It's someone she loves and who loves her. That's what matters. Through the half-open window, he could hear the children in the school beyond the fence and the little stream, the children yelling in the playground among the trees. I like that noise, she said. Cheers me up when I need cheering up. I had a burglar last week. A man rang the front doorbell and kept me talking about salvation while his pal came over the fence and down the garden and took my purse and my pension in it off the table, right where you're standing now. Keep the chain on your front door, love, the nice police lady said, and keep your back door locked. Oh well, she says, a bit shaky telling it. Worst things happen at sea. And two little girls from the school brought me that bunch of flowers. Our class is very sorry for what happened to you, Mrs. Gregory, they said. So that was a happy ending, wasn't it? And she set the teapot in its cheerful cosy on the trolley. Push that lot through, will you? I found some more photos. They were in another box under the bed. Sit down, she said, handing him his tea, and help yourself. Here's a plate. I got some of that cheese you like. On the trolley, besides that cheese, were some little meat pies and piccalilli, lettuce and tomatoes, a couple of balm cakes sliced for rings of tongue, a packet of cream crackers, tinned peaches ready in dishes, and next to them, the little can of Evap. Where were we?
Thank you. Thank you. Wow. So Our Glad it's really fascinating to hear you say it is a fiction, but rooted somehow in family history and real people, and that you felt free, that you gave yourself the freedom, so you didn't feel tied by that, or were there any moments that did feel difficult, do you think?
Well, obviously, I mean, family history has become a kind of obsession with the nation, if not the world, actually, and it's relatively easy to do it, unless your name's MacGregor. The wife of one of my fellow tutors before was Scott's name was MacGregor, and it's kind of hopeless, really. I mean, she was doing her best, but Constantine and Glebe, they're names that you could get some way, you know, without it being absolutely too much. But this distinction between fact and fiction is unsound anyway, because, and that's what I meant really, by tell it again, is it different?
You know? Yeah.
And it's effectively the same if when you read a book every, you know, read the same book 20 years later, you're not the same. The stuff on the page, the black dots on the page are exactly the same. And you reading it, you're not the same because you've shifted in the meantime, and your life experience to date is different, and then you, we have a very dear friend in Durham who reads Middlemarch. She has read it all her life, sort of every 10 years or so she reads it again.
Yeah.
And I feel exactly the same way about this family history stuff, really, that as it comes out and you see these things again, or for the first time, there's a sort of shock in it, where you place yourself now in that. And the dead are extraordinarily alive. There's no two ways about that.
Yeah.
And the living keep them alive.
Yeah.
A very close friend of ours died far too early, a wonderful woman, social worker, and founder of the Cyrenians with me and a couple of others in Durham City. And she died, and when she was dead, Helen said, do you remember what she used to say when you were leaving, and she was a Quaker, and she said, I will hold you in the light.
Oh.
That was the farewell, the goodbye. And there's something extraordinary about that, because you feel that you're holding her up in the light the whole time, because she's dead and gone in a certain sense, and then kind of not. And the idea that, you know, without believing in an afterlife which is in any sense literal, I do very strongly believe in it being kept alive, and everybody has a kind of constellations in the sky of people that they knew and loved. One of my dearest authors is Bertolt Brecht, who had and was in love with an extraordinary woman called Margarete Steffen, and she was a great help to him. She had hundreds of languages. She was fluent in four or five languages, including Russian and stuff. And she was a great corrector of his work. Mm. She would read it. And when she was dead, and she died of TB in the Moscow sanatorium, as they were making their way to the United States of America, safer to be there than in Moscow in 1942. When she was dead, he was at a loss for a long time, actually. And he said, she's there. He wrote a lovely poem about her being a constellation in the sky, the Stefanische constellation. And he said, and raising my head and listening, I hear a coughing. She was cold. He also said, very touchingly, that writing his own poems, he would write and then suddenly think and think again. And then he would cross the line out, knowing that she would not have thought that was any good. And that's not fanciful.
No, she was there.
She was there.
She was helping. Yeah.
And he's an absolute atheist in the way that I am, and a materialist, and probably more than I am. But, and that's not, I don't think of that as fanciful.
No. The way that people are brought to life through the storytellers, the record keepers, the women, as you say, in the family often, the ways people, and it happens in all of these stories, actually, the dead are very much among the living.
Yeah.
I think reading Our Glad, I could not stop thinking about my grandma, who, if she was still alive, would be in the early hundreds now. but that you use such turns of phrase, like the Lancashire kind of Salford, as was Lancashire at one point. The phrasing you use, the tea trolley, the tinned peaches, and evaporated milk, you conjure that world so vividly that all I could think about reading Hourglad was my grandmother. In fact, I'm wearing her watch tonight for that reason, because you made me think about her so strongly. And there's something about the role of the writer in that, being able to bring to life also the people for your readers, I suppose.
Yeah, the thing about all that food is that I'd long since stopped eating it. But, and she produced this trolley, and I didn't make an effort. Suddenly, it was there. She wheeled it in, and when she'd say, "I couldn't get any piccalilli, it's pickled onions. Is that all right?" Or, "I've got you that cheese you like," and it was all there. But evap, particularly, kind of evap. We'd all long since stopped having anything to do with that, and yet I just felt this is kind of sacred in some benign, in some peculiar fashion. I actually like. We sit down and she'd produce it, and I just find that, particularly when I think of her now, it's just deeply touching, really.
And the other thing she does that I was intrigued by is the photographs. So in the story, you return to lots of kind of old family photographs and the records that people have left of themselves, but also in particular, her mum, who had written "Just Me 1938 on the back, she had a habit of kind of recording her life almost in advance for the people who would come to the photographs afterwards.
That particular bit is awful, because the and this is the thing about family history, there's some stuff that they tell you, your mother and father tell you, or they it's kind of family stuff and you know about it. But when my father got he suffered badly from depression, and the doctor, they went back and thought what it might be, and they took it right back. And I don't think this is sound at all, but his twin sister burnt to death on a croft outside the house playing with matches. Her mother was cleaning a house at the time, and it was clearly, he was three, she was three. And they went right back saying, well, perhaps it was that. I don't think it was that at all, really. But, I mean, there are these things in family history. And the mother, the family went to bits after that, basically. I mean, there was the war, and he came back in a bad state. The father came back in a bad state. Not when he came back, my other grandfather didn't come back. He came back in a bad state, and there was this awful thing, and they rowed a lot, and they drank too much, and stuff, and the family held together kind of more or less, really, until the youngest got himself into the RAF at the age of 15, telling lies about his age, and was a kind of glamour boy then all over the world, flying these terrible flights over Germany, obviously, and thereafter. So there's always that stuff in the family, and her writing on the back of it, of that. Shall I read that bit? I mean, there's a picture of the twins, my father and his twin sister, and you can't even tell the sexes apart, actually, because they're in those sort of not baptismal roles, but they look like it, and you can't really, they look exactly the same. They're twins.
It's on page 91.
It's just a different. Gladys was one of those people who were kind of thwarted, really. I mean, she was the woman in the family who got left looking after the mother. That was always like that. I must ask you, do you know what the monkey run is? Have you come across this? The monkey run, I came across it again in Ewan McCall's autobiography. Mm. He, and the monkey run was where the women and the men, the girls and the boys, paraded up and down like that on a Saturday, not at first acknowledging one another, but the girls in pairs and the boys in pairs. And then little by little, this toing and froing, there was a bit of pairing up to it. And so if they carried on long enough, everybody was in pairs and they all vanished into the bushes or wherever. But it took an awful, it took a long time. And it was Gladys I first heard this term, the monkey run, from. And it was, you know, it was at the end of their street, then there'd be this sort of parade ground. It was absolutely extraordinary, really. Where they would, sorry, I could just go on like this, but she said she would be looking out there and she kind of piled up with a chap who said he'd come back the following weekend. And what she really wanted to know was whether he would be wearing a flat hat or a trilby. And she peered through the window until she could see this poor guy walking up and down. And he was wearing a flat cap. So she had notions, you know, so she said she just didn't go out. She just left him parading up and down until he'd given up. Because she wanted, basically she wanted George Formby, you know. Anyway, that's a long, and she had this thing that she called her Vilma Banky dress. Vilma Banky was a star of the silent movies from 1898 till 1991, which is a bit younger than my Auntie Gladys, clearly, but they were still around. It was 1991, she was 93 before she died, anyway. And they took this Vilma Banky dress off her and put it in the chest. And that was to keep her in. So. So it's here. Well then, she said, another thing in that trunk on the landing was the dress our Edith was wearing the day it happened, a cotton dress, Saxe blue, and wrapped in it was the doll she was playing with, a cloth doll with a big smile and golden curls. I knew Mother had kept them, or what was left of them, Father told me, but until I lifted the lid to get my favourite coat out, they confiscated her coat, to get my favourite coat out, I didn't know they were there. My Vilma Banky coat was lying on top of the dress and the doll, which gave me quite a turn when I uncovered them. I've only got one photo of Edith, I don't know why. Her and your dad together, actually, and it's in here somewhere. She rummaged. He watched her hands, how quick they were, not gentle, and her eyes also, watching for the thing her fingers would bring to light. They were fiercely intent. These are all coming to you, by the way, she said, not looking up. If you want them, that is. I do want them, he said. Got it, she said, and handed him the photograph, an oval of sepia brown cardboard, which, clearly, had been cut out from a larger print. The edges were uneven. The picture, like a medallion, had no surroundings. It was the bare heart of the matter, isolated without mitigation. The twins, 3 or 4 months old, sit each on a large floral cushion, with another cushion between them on a dark wooden settle, both almost bald, both in white frocks. One shows a hand, the other a hand and half a foot. One sits slumped against an arm of the settle, the other propped upright against its back. Which is which, he asked. That's your dad on the left, said Glad. They stare out, neither understands what is happening. Edith looks the more unsure, but that may be only how she has been placed in the angle and slumping down as though cowering away. See on the other side, said Glad, what Mother wrote. He turned the card over and read, my twins, one burned to death, the other lived to help me through my difficult time. G.A.C. Gertrude Adelaide Constantine. So it's a
it's a powerful thing. I think the fact she'd written that, recorded that way, particularly that way, as almost a way of wanting that story to be told that
way. Yes, that's right. I mean, you could chuck everything in a bonfire, you could destroy the whole lot. Those people did, and somehow they didn't. And once I was of a certain age, I was begging them not to. And I mean, there were all sorts of things like that. My grandmother on the other side had her husband was killed on the Western Front, and she just got these few bits that you get from the king and places. But she had a whole stack of letters from him that he'd written from the front and while he was training. And the story is, and I believe it, that in after the Sycamore War, just after, she gave them all to salvage because there was this big drive to get paper in. I just couldn't believe it when I heard that, and it was some misguided notion of having already given her husband to the nation that the letters themselves were. That really upset me, actually.
Yeah.
Because I would have liked to see. I got loads of postcards from him that he wrote to my mum and the rest of the family, but her letters. Family's a strain.
Yeah. Do you think, as a writer, do you think writers, it's almost that it's the writers in the family as well, that writers are prone to keeping these kinds of things where they can? Because I know I have my great grandfather's letters when his arm was taken off in a paper mill and he died in 1913, and I'm the one, nobody else in my family is interested, they would have been thrown away.
Yeah.
I'm the one who kept them.
Well, I do think that, and I've. My brother's a historian and a very good one, and history is a different discipline.
Yeah.
And I felt very early on with my gran, the other gran at home, who particularly towards the end of her life started talking more about John William Lee. Mm. And I thought, it's up to me, this.
Yeah.
I don't mean I was going to appropriate it, but there was somebody who wanted to, and actually modestly as could do. And the first time I really knew I got a subject, apart from the love poems I was already writing, was him. And because I'd never wanted to appropriate experience that is absolutely not mine, I mean, I would never, ever write about the Holocaust or stuff like that. And I only wrote about the First World War through my gran. I've read loads of First World War poetry and accounts of it, endless, and I can imagine it, but I wasn't there. Whereas my gran was there.
Yeah.
And I could write about her.
Yeah.
And then later it was the same with my mother and my dad first of all, and then my mum, and then and Gladys is the one who carried on talking to the end. Yeah. My father didn't, and nor did my mum really. She couldn't, once she'd nursed him, she lost. But Gladys carried right on. I mean, in hospital, I visited her in hospital just before she died, and she was fast asleep, and I said, and the nurse said, wake her up. So I woke her up.
And that's in the story as well, isn't it? And the final line of the story is, come on in, our glad, he said, start talking.
Yeah.
So she's still talking.
Well, she is, yeah. It's a nice thing, isn't it?
Should we have something from the first story in the book now?
Yeah, this is this is the one called Living in Hope, because there's as much hope as I could summon, which is quite a bit, actually.
This is interesting for being a short story set during the pandemic as well, which I haven't read that much fiction yet, but is kind of responding to that time.
This is, she's called Dr. Victoria Okolowicz, and she's a Polish academic, really, she's living in Paris, and she's researching the commune. And when I was writing this, it was the 150th, when I first started teaching in Durham, those were the days, they said, what would you like to teach? And I said, Brecht, Days of the Commune, because it was, carry on, you know. It was it was the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the commune, and then 50 years later, it's the 150th clearly, and I became absolutely obsessed all over again. And her problem is that she knows too much, really, as a historian. She's taking it in, and in the end, she can't bear it.
Mm.
And partly because it's Zoom. And there's no proper meetings, but and I've had this happen to me, and I don't know what it's supposed to happen, but suddenly there's no audience, it's just you. There's just your face as the sole thing on the screen. Mm-hmm. And she'd heard a talk given by a fellow academic about how the commune didn't really happen, and it wasn't that important, and it's all exaggerated, and this incensed her. So what she gave, really effectively speaking to herself, was the sum total of dreadful atrocities.
Yeah.
And then she can't stand it because she's taking it in. And it's locked down, but she's still going out. And she, whenever we go to Paris, I go to Père Lachaise, which is where the commune ended against this so-called Mur des Fédérés. They lined up the last 186 along the wall and shot them. And that whole quarter of that cemetery now is entirely given over to memorials, to the commune, but also to lots of the death camps, the Holocaust and so forth. So it's the northeast area of that cemetery is entirely a memorial. Anyway, she, as it were, pulled to it, comes back to the Père Lachaise Cemetery and goes then and sits facing the wall and contemplates the wall where it ended. Or shall I read this bit then? So she's sitting there in Père Lachaise. Is it possible for a human being, even for an interlude, to have no thoughts? Facing the wall, Victoire came near that vacancy. There were wraiths or miasmas in her head, rising out of some frightful depth, curling, shaping towards things that might have been articulated, but recoiling into the fog. Her eyesight functioned in much the same fashion. All along the base of the wall, she could make out the sprawling dead, but unclearly in the sort of mist you see over meadows and marshland, some early promising mornings, soundlessly, in lovely slow whirling, shaping, unshaping, in a movement that has only the appearance of progressing, the motion all being upwards, out of the earth, into the air's lowest stratum, where they rolled like surf, but in silence and not advancing. She saw the bare feet of the dead, their soiled pallor, as in dreams, and in too much meditation she had seen them often before, so wanting comfort, so beyond all comfort. Then was it nothing new? She had spiralled as though summoned to this centre, and for nothing new. Hopelessness rose in her. She felt herself to be a living thing, rooted in harm, forever drawing up not sustenance but malefaction, which through the bloodways and their infinite small branchings infected her body and soul. She shuddered and clutched with both hands at her heart. The wall cleared. It stood in sunlight. Victoire became aware of the singing of birds. Two children came onto the set, the stage, a boy of perhaps 10 or 11, a girl about half that age. Hand in hand, they entered from the left. This was a theatre she had not seen since childhood. She watched, spellbound, wholly believing. At first she supposed them to be brother and sister. Both were black, but soon noticed their difference in complexion and facial features and hair. Red roses, as almost always, and especially in May, were lying along the base of the wall, in wreaths of immortelles hung on the face of it. Midway, the little girl, in a white dress and her hair tied back in bunches with red ribbons, stooped and picked up a rose. Only then did Victoire realise they must for some while have had her in view. And now they turned to face her. The girl was serene and smiling over a secret intention. The boy, in soft blue-grey trousers and a long-sleeved shirt, had a face which was helplessly open. Nothing he thought and felt would be kept from exposure in such a face. The girl handed him the rose, glanced Victoire's way, and nudged at him with her shoulder. He shook his head. She nudged him again, harder, and signalled with her head what she commanded him to do. It seemed he would have to screw up all his courage, and the little girl knew that, and for his own good she was putting him to the test. He drew a deep breath, and almost at a run, came before Victoire, sitting there entranced on her sepulchral slab. Bowing his head so as not to show his face or look into hers, clumsily he held up the rose for her to accept. She took it. He stepped three or four paces back. She began to smile, began to say a fit thank you to him, and the girl, who stood still at the wall, radiant with delight at the courteous, brave thing she had made him do. But holding the rose, regarding it in wonder, the rose and the children, the so serious boy, the so delighted girl, contemplating the flower, the children, the wall, very suddenly, as never in her life before, never in any desolation in childhood or girlhood or in her adult life, She was broken open by weeping. She shook with it, and dropping the gift and not covering her face with her hands, she clutched her own shoulders tight, rocked to and fro and wept, as if become the source into daylight and lovely sunlight of all the bitter waters that lie in a lake of cold blackness under the earth. The boy's face showed an unmanageable terror. He turned and ran back to his companion, who was staring in blank incomprehension at the rose on the ground, and a grown woman, an adult, a creature there to look after you, weeping without end, shuddering and clutching her own shoulders as though if she let go she would fall to bits, weeping and showing the children all her horror and sadness and shame in her far too open face. Hand in hand, they fled.
Thank you. Oh, I have to say, David, there's that moment where she spirals around us and she's walking in the city and she finds herself drawn to the wall in the cemetery. But then she sits there and she waits. And it's almost like she knows that something important is going to happen. And that happens, so like that often happens in your stories. I think that there's like a luminous moment, something where things change and from that excerpt you just read, it's full of sadness. But actually, that is the moment in the story, That is the turning point where hope comes in, and the relationship between her and these children and the woman who is their guardian actually is where all the hope is in the story. But just that moment, the chance meeting, the fact that she was drawn at that very moment to sit there and then enter the children. I thought, do you find yourself waiting, holding the space for those moments in life as well? Do you write them because you recognise how they happen?
There have been numerous moments in my life when something has... Eliot talks about writing poetry as being a passive attending upon the event.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's passive, but it is, and I know what he means. And the event is the coming in of something.
The being open.
You're being open to it. And when he's talking about writing the poem, then it's that sort of passivity to let things come in. Because if you're perpetually grasping at it, you're not going to get it. So a passivity is that, and a not knowing what is coming.
Yeah.
You can't live like that, clearly, but you have to make, I think, in your life, spaces like that, by one means or another. So, yeah.
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 And it is, in that story, it is beautiful, the relationship, the friendship that develops and what that means. But also, I love, there's a line slightly later on where the guardian of the children, who has fled war herself, and the academic is feels guilty almost for being so moved, doesn't she? For carrying the weight of events that she hasn't experienced directly herself. So yeah. There's that question of what right do you have at a given point to tell a story? And her friend says to her that she wants her to go on and teach. And she says this, she wants her to say to her students, this is what truth looks like from my point of view.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so important that way. And like you said about writing about the First World War through your grandmother's experience of it, there's a link there.
Yeah, so. I mean, you always feel it's a vicarious experience. It's not yours, but it's through somebody else who's on behalf of.
Yeah.
I mean, Rilke, the very great poet, I think, it's not quite my favourite, but he talks about the German for it, it's Das alles war Antrag. I was waiting and this was asked of me to do. So it's the passivity, das alles war Auftrag. It's the commission. Now it sounds terribly pompous. And he was a bit like that. But he was immensely open to all these things. The things in the world, he said, are pressing to be said. Now it's things, it's not just people, it's things and trees, flowers, events pressing to be said, and that's the onus of it. So it's a kind of onus, but I mean, a good one.
Yeah. And when I'm thinking about that, it makes me think of how there are very, you write about, I think quite, for me, they're often quite quiet stories with, I was trying to explain it to my husband, why I love them so much. They're quite quiet stories about people living their everyday lives, but it's almost like there's an explosion underneath. There's always longing and loss, and yeah. There is such power in lives that from the outside people might dismiss or not realise that people are kind of being rocked by those passions in that moment. And... yeah, I don't know where I was going with that.
No, I mean, I think that's... I mean, clearly every human life is worth your attention. There's no doubt about that, really. Yeah. And an awful lot of people who think of themselves... I mean, that was part of this kind of... where I came from, where I grew up from, you know. It's a striking thing about that class. I'm not going to call it the working class quite, although my... grandmother's side definitely was that. He was a warehouse man who joined up. The other half, yeah, they were in the post office. And he said, get yourself in the post office, it would save the job. But there's that feeling that my mother and father had very strongly, actually, that they're just ordinary people. And so what? You know, this is how it is. But if you actually start looking at anybody, really, with a proper seriousness, then... It's worth telling.
Yes.
I mean, I mustn't sound simply, but there are a powerful number of people around who are vile at the minute. I mean, absolutely evil people in positions of power. And they need writing about as well, but it's quite difficult to do if you're not actually in dealings with them the whole time.
Yeah.
So the antidote to that, I think, in practically everything I've written, there's some sort of answering back against this sort of willed evil or willed diminishing of what a human being actually is.
Yeah.
It's happening continually. It's a sort of, unless you answer back and help other people to answer back, then it's a sort of enslavement, really, and a belittling of what it is to be human.
Yeah.
And we've got a politics now, at this minute, which belittles the human. It does all sorts of stuff with it, and the effect of it is demeaning.
I like that. That is the antidote. That we need those.
Yeah.
We really do. Should we move on to the final story?
Yeah. Okay. This needs a little bit more. This is the title story, and it's this poet I've spent. Most of my life, I can now say, actually, reading and rereading, Friedrich Hölderlin, who was born in 1770, the same year as Wordsworth and Beethoven, the year to be born in. you were very young when the French Revolution brought, 19, when it started, and that seemed to a lot of people born then to be the actual beginnings now of a better society. It ends in grievous disappointment. Hölderlin was put in Swabia, in the southern part of Germany, Protestant area, and you got your education free in this very good Tübingen Stift, it was called, the seminary in Tübingen. Your education was free, provided you became a vicar when you left.
Not so free.
Yeah, not so free. And in the same college, two of them in the same year was not just Hölderlin, but Schlegel and Hegel, Schelling and Hegel. The three of them were in the same seminary together. It's absolutely extraordinary that not one of them ended up as a vicar, clearly. Hölderlin was the poet. And your only way of resisting it was to take a job that could be loosely called educational for a while. So, and they went as house tutors in the households of the bourgeoisie, where they were demeaned. They were another adjunct to the bit of the family, and they were demeaned. And in Hölderlin's case, he went to work for a banker, in Frankfurt, whose motto in life, despite being married to Suzette Gontard, this extraordinarily beautiful and gifted woman, was les affaires avant tout, business first. That was his sort of family crest and motto. And he understood the role of the women in the household as to keep it pretty, you know, lots of flowers around, see to the education of the children, play a piano. And Hölderlin comes into this household, already known to her, because she's read excerpts of his work. And
she says, I've read you, doesn't she? Which I thought was lovely.
And they fall in love. And it's one of the great tragic love affairs in the history of the world, really.
Yeah.
She was exceedingly gifted, and she died of scarlet fever, nursing her children in 1802. When Hölderlin was still trying to make a living by being a house tutor, this time in Bordeaux, miles away. And that point, then his mental state was getting increasingly dubious. He came back and lasted a while, and then he was actually forcibly taken away and incarcerated in the hospital, which is just above the seminary. And there he was treated in the way that they treated so-called mad people then. And he was discharged then with at most 3 years to live, they said. And in fact, he lived another 36 or so. And he lived in this tower on the banks of the Neckar. And he was taken in, not by his own family, who wanted nothing to do with him, but by a carpenter and his wife and daughter particularly, and they took him in and they looked after him. They really did look after him. But he was kind of pestered the whole time by visitors, as people came by to see this mad guy and to get him to write them a little poem. So. Anyway, in 1822, a young man called Weiblinger, Wilhelm Weiblinger, also in the Stift, also heading for a vicarage unless he did something about it, befriended him. And there was a kind of lucid interlude in 1822 when Weiblinger was 18. And there was a kind of point in Hölderlin's madness when he could, if he chose to, speak in ways that were intelligible to somebody willing to listen. And Weiblinger won his confidence. Weiblinger, he wrote the first biography of Hölderlin, a brief one, and he then took himself off to Italy, had a common law wife there and two or three children, and died at the age of 25, 6, and is buried near Keats and Shelley in the Protestant cemetery in Rome. Now this is Weiblinger speaking. I have met a poet, a real one, the wreck of one. I was staring into the river, thinking it might, after all, be pleasanter to be a cadaver in those waters than a student of theology in the prison house, when I felt behind me, shiver down my spine, the smiling of a saviour angel. I turned and saw her. No girl more beautiful have I ever seen, nor ever will. She stood in the tower doorway on the step. At her back I saw the staircase into the upper room, and she smiled and said, "Come in if you like. I suppose you wish to meet our gentleman lodger." So an angel, in the form of his keeper's lovely daughter, knowing my heart's requirement, smiles and beckons me in. Henceforth, I have a calling. I will know him and love him, and the rest can go to hell. Hush, hush, write quietly and exactly how it was. She stood aside, her arm outstretched. I climbed the spiral staircase to a landing, and there, at his open door, he stood. "Go in," she said, and left us. Quite a tall man, broad-shouldered, stooping slightly, he wore a loose smock and trousers belted below the waist. His hands were in his pockets. As I approached, he bowed, and I saw the balding crown of his head. I begged pardon for intruding upon him. Continually bowing, he backed into the room, all the while addressing me as Your Majesty, Your Grace, Your Royal Highness, and speaking fast in a mix of tongues. I took his retreating and his extravagant courtesy to mean I should follow him in. When he halted, I did. The room is an amphitheatre, in it a bed, a chair, a small table, a piano, a dresser on which are a few books, and a very well-made model of a Greek temple. The walls and ceiling of his room are whitewashed. He has a view through the window across the river to the orchards and vineyards, and behind them the level hills. In the window stands a lectern. Nothing came to me to say. I stared through tears. He bowed again and again, almost to the floor, freed his right hand, and with it made strange rolling gestures of extreme deference. His nails are long. "May I come again, sir?" I asked. "Ah, your holiness," he replied. "Forgive me, that is the question I cannot, I may not answer." Then the rapid babble of tongues. He has an old man's mouth. His cheeks are cleft with sorrow. His frame is at times suddenly jolted, as though lightning passed through it. His eyes cower deep in their sockets. They look out fearfully. Then I saw them find the girl, who had entered without a sound behind me, and at once they were reassured. They lit up with thanks. In that illumination, his face and his whole person were beautiful. I took my leave. In truth, I fled. "Come again, sir," she said. "I think he will grow to trust you."
Thank you. And of course, he does visit again many times. And the story moves between the voices of Hölderlin and his biographer, and also Suzette, who is dead, but is very much part of the conversation. Yeah. And between her and Hölderlin, there's this beautiful thing where you don't know where the poem with whom the poem begins or ends. It moves between them. It's absolutely heartbreaking, but beautiful.
Yeah, that was one of the last poems that he wrote in those verse forms, and it's in her voice. That's why she says, "It's my hands."
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's hers. I loved as well, there's a thing, so one of my very favourites of your stories is called The Sheeling.
Yeah.
And it's a story I've loved for many years and gone back to many times. And it has, the best opening sentence of any short story I can think of. "They invented a place." That's the opening sentence. I love that. And that, it's about a couple who have a thwarted love inventing an imaginary place where they can meet and be together. And in some ways, I read echoes in this story of that story, because they too have to create imaginary places. They have to write into being the places where they can actually be together.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Thwarted, How do you find, so this has some of your own translations in it as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've translated quite a lot of them.
Yeah. What is the relationship for you between translating and then writing? And
well, I've translated him more, over the years, more and more, and Neil Astley has published the translations, and translation is the closest reading. It's the closest of close reading, so you really do get to, well, as far as your ability goes, you get to know what is happening in these things, and you try to find an English which suits.
To get as close as you can.
He got his own German through Greek, through ancient Greek. He translated this extremely difficult poet, Pindar, literally. That is, not just word by word, but syllable by syllable, deliberately knowing exactly what he was doing. And it produces a German which is unintelligible, except that every now and then, by this extraordinary, the same method, it produces a language which is just uncannily beautiful. It's German, but it's been pushed through into something which is, and that's how he got his own language.
Right.
Is through translation and through forcing the language to do things that it hadn't previously been able to do. And that's what really great writers do. They shift the language.
Yeah.
and I said earlier, Hölderlin only became well-read, widely read in Germany at the time of the First World War.
Right.
And then thereafter. There are new editions, and he becomes the poet even more of our times than he was of the times of the French Revolution and the disappointment of the Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars that followed. So. Yeah. But he got a language, and I keep, and every writer has to get at her or his own language, and you've got to shape it until it is. And you do. I mean, I've found translation enormously helpful in that respect, yeah, because languages work differently. Very differently in some cases. And it's sometimes the case, as with Hölderlin, that he saw just how Greek he could make this without losing its Germanness.
And I think it's really interesting you said that it's as close as you can get, like, to translate is the closest you can get. And then there's a line in the story where the student has gone and tried to follow in the footsteps, yeah, hasn't he, of Hölderlin, and he meets someone who saw an altercation in the street, him being taken away, and another character says, "You touched the life." And I think that, you know, when you're talking about translation, it's about touching the life, getting as close as, yeah, you can to the, through the words of the writer.
Yeah, he meets, and this is feasible, that it's made up, but it's feasible. He meets a young woman with a baby who was small when Hölderlin was forcibly removed from the last place he was living in, and in society, really, by force. They sent a carriage for him and they pulled him out, dragged him out. He scratched their faces with his long nails and they beat him up in the carriage, and he was carted off, and she saw it. That's the idea, that was a witness to that.
And a witness who was able to pass that story
on. Right, yeah.
And another thing that I did mention before we started the event, I said, oh, I was going to ask you about walking. And I realise as we're getting towards the end, I've not asked you about walking yet. But there is another, so the student, he walks, he tries to undertake a journey that Hölderlin wasn't able to take, doesn't he? And he walks in his footsteps along the different rivers. And I did want to ask you about what walking means for your writing and your practice.
Well, it's absolutely colossal.
Practice.
And in Hölderlin's case, he said he believes Suzette to be still alive.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to walk to Frankfurt, where she is, and you can't keep me from. So they confiscated his boots. I mean,
so
they had to. It was they were responsible for him, this carpenter and his, and the family, so they took his boots away for a while. So I make my Weibling, I say, well,
yeah,
I'll do it for you.
Yeah.
I'll go now to Frankfurt and tell you what it's like when I get back. And indeed, he could find out quite a lot. When you walk along the river and he hitch rides on boats and stuff. And when I first began with Hölderlin in 1966-7, actually doing my PhD, that was a bit odd as well, because the archive then was in a place called Bebenhausen, outside Tübingen, in deep snow, and I walked from where we were living with this tiny baby in Weilheim, and I would walk through the forest to this archive, which was extraordinary, because it was, Hölderlin was a poet that the Nazis tried to appropriate. And they turned up for the 1943 celebration of the date of his birth. And there's all these photographs that nobody bothered. Nobody said you shouldn't be looking at these things. But all these guys in Nazi uniform, sitting on the front row while there was a lecture on Hölderlin. So it's that sort of stuff. And then I walked from Tübingen to just outside Strasbourg, because that was a walk he did in deep snow, and it was really deep as well, just to kind of, that was the trip across Germany and then into France, where they addressed him as citoyen still, even though it was Napoleon by that time, and he said that his profession was homme de lettres, man of letters, is it? There's this insistence on them, and that was his walk into France and then to Bordeaux, and I did that first bit.
So you've done the walk as well?
Well, I get it, as the character says, and I get it through my feet.
Yeah.
And somebody, I've always, I'm always citing this, somebody once, rather contemptuously said, of John Clare, where'd you get your poems from, John? Meaning, how could you? You know, he said, I kick them out of the clod. I kick them out of the clods. And Wordsworth, if you go to the Dove Cottage, there's a kind of platform at the back of it through which he used to escape and visit. And he just paraded up and down there, composing. All the romantics were great walkers.
Yeah.
It's the rhythm of walking when it's safe to do so. You can't, as it were, get on the top of Crib Goch and start walking. It's dangerous.
No.
But when the path is, you can actually see it, and use the rhythm of walking, the rhythm of thought.
So has walking been a big part of your writing process?
Yes,
then?
It's always.
Okay, I think we could open up to see if anyone has any questions. Anybody? I have some just in case no one does. Rah! Thank you.
I have a lifetime of questions.
Yeah.
Two of the stories, the first story and the last story, kind of look at characters who live through moments of, kind of look at moments of change. You know, you have Hodelin was there as a young man during the French Revolution, and then you had the communards and the Paris Commune. But you choose to look at kind of later versions of, you choose to look back on those events, knowing their failures. And knowing how badly they turned out, why do you do that rather than look at the early kind of honeymoon period of those moments, and the moments of hope when, you know, the French Revolution was promised so much, and when the Paris Commune promised so much?
Well, I suppose it's partly in my nature to go. To go through with it, and I don't think that in a fiction, at least, that actually even in historical reality, that this colossal slaughter that they perpetrated after the commune did not finish it. I mean, an awful lot came into force then, just as an awful lot came into force in Britain and in France through the French Revolution and through the whole 18th century, actually. And you get this, there's this movement forward, and then there's the repression. I've seen it in my lifetime. I mean, 1944 is the Education Act, 1947 is the Labour government and the National Health Service. It moves on, and then comes Thatcher, and there's a shoving of it back, and we're in another period now of it being shoved back, and quite drastically in Europe, actually, in places like Hungary.
Yeah.
And it's unbearable in lots of ways, but it's not as though that is the triumph of it. It isn't. And it's true, I think, that certain ideas put into circulation are ineradicable. They're not going to go away, that we hold these truths to be self-evident. That's powerful, that. We hold these truths to be self-evident, and that's the equality of people and the rights of people. We hold them to be self-evident. And they are. It's just that every now and then they get a whole lot of shit thrown over them by the powers that can do that sort of stuff. I don't think I'm pessimistic, actually. I mean, Burgee, when we knew him, Hedlund and I edited Modern Poetry and Translation, and he was a great distinguisher between optimism and hope. He said, I am not an optimist, but I am hopeful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hope is the act of resistance in that, isn't it? Hope is the act of resistance.
It is, exactly that. Yeah. It is the resistance. Yeah. And otherwise, if they could... Well, it's the candle in the wire, it's the amnesty signal, that extraordinary image like that, the candle shining through the wire is it, really. That's what they knew very well when they
eyes then. It's terrific.
And you can't see, you can't look at children and think it's hopeless. I mean, you know, it's not good, but it's not hopeless. And in fact, increasingly with climate change, this desperate generation of ours are shoving it all onto the kids and saying, well, you know, children are hopeful, they'll
sort it out.
They'll sort
it out. Yeah, a lot of anyone else have any questions?
Yeah, lots of things. So I come along tonight because I saw it pop up on just my Instagram feed, and I've just drawn to the name of the book.
Oh,
maybe
nice.
in a similar way to yourself in the bookshop, it just sort of jumped out to me. And then I think in another sort of like interesting, I feel like for a reason it jumps out, because my nana lives in Ngambwe and has been widowed, and my dad and his brother take turns going up to visit her, and I'll come along and listen to her stories. And just in a similar way to yourself, of your old family member keeping your family history alive. And
yeah.
With my dad's side, it's a very small family, so very conscious that it is the little last remaining source of the stories.
Yeah.
But just on a question level, I wanted to know if you think, in terms of not exploring history, but like exploring the past, what does fiction, especially like a short story, offer that maybe history doesn't? Or do you reckon there's something which fiction can give you which maybe history can't in the traditional sense?
That's a good question.
I think, yeah, it's a very good question. This is where my beloved brother is a historian and a very good one, and spent more time than is good for him as the expert witness in all these awful child molestation cases, because he knew what was going on, and he found it all in the Home Office. He's a historian of that as well, really, and he sat through tribunal after tribunal as an expert witness, and that those are facts. The previous volume, he put me on to atrocities that I couldn't bear, and in the central story in that one, when I was a child, the worst things in that are true, factually true. What the Christian Brothers did to children in their so-called care, actually at their mercy. Well, I made a fiction of it using historical facts as much of that as I could actually bear. And I think if you can put it into not just a context, but actually try to make people feel that these are people feeling, for good or ill, that's a different way of doing it. I've never wanted to write historical novels as such, because as part of what I said right at the beginning, I wasn't there, and I can imagine it all too well sometimes, but the Rivers of Blood thing that you did and Enoch Powell, I could do that because I was on the march into the immigrant area of Oxford that was objected straight away, and we deliberately went across Magdalen Bridge, and that was the end of the Gown bit, and then it's the town bit, and we walked through the immigrant area, and they stood there looking at us wondering what we were doing, I suppose, really. But that's history that I understood a bit of because I was there. And the First World War and the Second World War, likewise. So I'm not a historian, and I every now and then can, you know, the stuff is close enough to me for me to be able to, I mean, put it very, very crudely, I would never write about Auschwitz. I said, my subject is German, was German. I've not been to Auschwitz, I've been to two or three of the others, and it's appalling, it's beyond belief appalling, and I can't write about that because I wasn't there, really. And it would be like appropriating an experience which, now with my grandmother, I didn't feel I was appropriating something, I felt that I was speaking for somebody.
Yeah.
And that's one of the differences between it.
Thank you for the readings, David. Really powerful. Can I ask you about drafting? I mean, your stories, there's such precision, such detail, and you've talked about the phrasing and emotion. Does that all come out in the first draft? Do you layer it on? that's just interesting about that process.
Yeah. What I don't do is work out what's going to happen. I know writers that do, who actually plan the whole thing and stick to it. And I was talking to Karis Davis, Zooming, the other day, and she, in one of her stories, she put this, something from, I think it's either Gide or one of those, from his diaries, where he says, "The sentences of mine I like best are those whose endings I don't know." And that's the sentence. So it's writing a sentence without knowing how it's going to conclude. And then enlarged, then it's the story without. And if I thought I knew what was going to happen to my people, I think I wouldn't be doing it, because it's trying to give them the agency to be themselves, even if they're my creations. I haven't mentioned him so far, but I mean, Lawrence is the writer, extraordinary for coming to an ending, which is actually absolutely not a closing. If you look at the end of Sons and Lovers, he walks the town quickly. There's a comma, and then the very last word of Sons and Lovers is quickly. Quick. And it's a life opening off. He's lost his mother, and he now has to find a way of living. So it's beginning, in a sense. And it's his short stories are like that, almost all of them. So that's what I'm aiming at, I suppose, is that going into stuff which affects me deeply, and working out what's in it, and then feeling, and I think rightly, that there is no end to this, that the human lives don't just suddenly stop like that, and then you find out in it, and that stuff. It's not like that. So if you can write, and that means sentence by sentence, in such a way that it's moving, and as for the Gide said, you know, I don't know quite how this thing is going to end. So I don't plan them, I write them. There's a good poem by Robert Graves about precisely them going wrong and carrying on, and it's something like ignoring the warning lights to left and right as you do, and you reach the end and it's all wrong. And he says, put it aside, you fail. So it's that sort of feeling of, not as it were, grasping already where this thing is going to finish and aiming for that. And I think, in truth, you can't have such an aim.
You talk about Lawrence writing Lady Chatterley's Lover in one go, one sitting, and then the whole thing, and then
three,
not liking it,
three
and then throwing it away, starting again.
Three drafts. Yeah.
So not going back and editing it,
no,
but just starting from scratch.
Three goes at it, full-length novel. And Frieda was, there's a note in Frieda Lawrence's reminiscence of Martin, and what she speaks of, and this it's in Edward Thomas as well, is she speaks in sort of mesmerised interest at the hand just moving across the page, Lawrence's hand, just like that. This thing, you know, the hand itself with the pen, just, and it coming forth out of it. And there's an Edward Thomas poem precisely of that same thing, this hand as the agent of it, out of which this is coming. And it may be right or it may be wrong, but in the end, something is passing from there to your fingertips and a pen, if you use a pen or whatever.
I wanted to ask, so since 2005 you've been publishing collections quite regularly with comma, and I just wondered what that's meant for your writing practice, working with comma over that period of time.
I can't put words to it without himself over there. No, seriously,
yeah.
He's the best, and I was dead lucky because I had Neil Astley just starting up. I've been with Neil ever since, and that's somebody who set up in opposition to the Metropolis.
Yeah,
Blood
so it's
Axe.
That Blood Axe,
Eric,
yeah.
Blood Axe,
yeah.
was against the Metropolis and against the whole London thing. And he was, because I was living in Durham then, I was kind of on the spot, and he didn't, as it were, chuck me when I moved south, kindly.
Yeah, kept you as a northern writer.
Yeah, I think, and it's the same with Colin. I mean, that's, I mean, well, I don't want to embarrass the man.
But I think it says, well, the pile of books speak for themselves and the pleasure they bring and seeing your writing over the years, and how that relationship has worked. Yeah, I think. Thank you from a reader as well. Oh, I've embarrassed him.
He lives in Hope Mill.
That's where the hope is. Okay, well, I think we should finish there. That's okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, that was great. We've got coffee through the books over sale, over by the till, and David, if you're happy, signing at the front, he'll sign copies for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is it still running?